The story takes place in Old Testament times at the end of a period known as the Exile, in which Jerusalem and its temple were destroyed, burned to the ground, and its people were forcibly relocated to Babylon and to Persia, hundreds of miles to the east. And we've heard recently how a small group of people who returned to Judah and to Jerusalem were motivated to rise up and work together to begin to rebuild Jerusalem's walls. Chapter 4 finds this rebuilding effort under threat, both from within and from without. The people are under the threat of ridicule, they're under the threat of discouragement, and they are under the threat of attack from their enemies. But through Nehemiah's leadership and with God's help, the people stand firm. They work together to complete the wall. This chapter opens with the people facing the threat of ridicule in their work to rebuild. At the center of the opposition, once again, are two figures by the name of Sanballat and Tobiah, whom we met back in chapter 2. Where Nehemiah said they were very much disturbed that someone like Nehemiah had come all this way to promote the welfare of the Israelites. These two were officials in nearby Samaria who exercised a considerable amount of control over the region so far from the auspices of the king. And they had the most to lose if there was a rebuilt and fortified Jerusalem right next door. And so they mocked and they ridiculed the project from the beginning. Back in chapter 2, they said, "What is this that they are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" But by chapter 4, their dismissive and contemptuous tone has kind of become one of desperation and concern, as they realize that Nehemiah and his companions might actually succeed in their project. Now it tells us that Sanballat was angry and greatly incensed. He says in verse 2, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble burned as they are?" In verse 3, Tobiah chimes in too. "What they're building, even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones." Their taunts that both the Jews and their wall are feeble and of no consequence, I think, reflect a very deep insecurity about what the people are able to accomplish with God's help. They're watching this wall go up and getting more and more concerned. But just because their mockery reflects their own insecurity doesn't mean that the builders on the wall are unaffected. Nehemiah seems to imply in verse 5 that they intentionally threw their insults within hearing of the builders on the wall in order to intimidate and demoralize them. Nehemiah says that their taunts are a reproach and a disgrace, a word that he's used repeatedly in the first couple of chapters, to reflect the sorry state of Jerusalem's walls and the impoverished and unprotected state of its inhabitants. These reproaches, this disgrace, may have struck a nerve with the people on the wall as they recognized at least some truth in what Sanballat and Tobiah were saying. And so the threat of ridicule from without contributes to the threat of discouragement from within. As the project reaches its halfway point, this initial enthusiasm and unity of purpose that the people displayed back in chapter 2 has worn off, and morale is low. The builders have taken up a dispiriting little chant of their own that spread quickly along the walls. The rhyme and the meter of this little two-line ditty has an air of futility and onerousness about it. Robert Alter kind of restores the poetry of their little song, and it says, "Failed is the strength of the basket bearer. There is so much rubble, and we are unable to build the wall." Imagine this tune echoing up and down the walls as the people worked. Come a long way from their high point in chapter 2, from the enthusiasm of, come, let us rebuild the wall, to this despondent, we'll never be able to rebuild the wall. People are tired. They are discouraged. Many of them are ready to throw in the towel. This task is too big. Their resources too small and their enemies too powerful. Which brings us to the threat of attack. By verse 7, the coalition against Nehemiah and the builders has grown to include not just Sanballat and Tobiah and their followers, but Arabs and Ammonites and Ashdodites. They're literally surrounded north, south, east, and west. And verse 8 tells us they all plotted together to come up and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against previous attempts to rebuild the wall, like back in Ezra chapter 4, had been successfully thwarted by use of force. And if all else failed, Jerusalem's enemies, at least some of whom had trained armies at their command, were prepared to resort to violence again. Verse 11, they say, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them, and we'll kill them and put an end to their work. Fearing attack, the Jews in the more vulnerable outlying villages repeatedly beg their workers to come home. The situation is dire. In verses 10 through 12, there's just this rapid fire accumulation of crises, from threat of imminent attack, from failing morale, from the calls from their own people to abandon the project. This is a critical moment in Nehemiah's leadership. As to his response, and we now turn, we see right away that prayer once again plays a prominent role in Nehemiah's response. We've seen that that's his habitual pattern, responding to threats with both prayer and action. In verse 9, when the enemies threatened attack, Nehemiah says, "We prayed to our God and we posted a guard to meet the threat." When the enemies hurled ridicule and insults at the builders of the wall, Nehemiah responds in verses 4 and 5 with a prayer of lament and vindication modeled on the Psalms. "Hear us, O God, for we are despised," he says. "Turn their insults back on their own heads." Nehemiah doesn't respond to their mockery and taunting in kind, but through prayer, he hands retribution over to God. This is Nehemiah's consistent response to the schemes of Sanballat and Tobiah, even as their attacks become more devious and more personal, as we'll see next week. So first, Nehemiah prays. The second, he prepares to defend the wall. Though few, if any, of the builders are trained in any form of combat, they're not particularly well armed. Nehemiah immediately posts a guard, and he stations some of the people, family by family. These are not trained soldiers. At the most vulnerable and exposed sections of the wall. And having set up these basic security measures, he sets out to establish a more organized defense. The people took it in shifts to work on rebuilding or standing guard. Verse 16 tells us that from that day on, half of them did the work, always carrying a sword at their side, while the other half stood guard, equipped with such weapons and armor as they had available. The workers were on their guard night and day, ready to rally to the sound of the trumpet if they were attacked. Nehemiah himself sets an example of constant vigilance, remaining dressed and ready for action at all times until the wall is finished. Finally, Nehemiah rallies and encourages the people. He says in verse 14 that after I looked things over, I stood up and said to the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes." This is really the heart of the chapter right here. In the face of threat and opposition, Nehemiah says, don't be afraid. Remember the Lord and fight for your own. He appeals to them on the basis of their homes and their families and the very future of their community. And it reminds them that though their resources and experience are limited, our God will fight for us. He calls on them to remember the Lord, to remember their history, to remember how God had delivered and defended their people in the past, and can and will do so again today. The result is that when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated, we all returned to the wall, each to our own work. Thomas Petter writes that from this point on, the tide has turned. That unity of purpose that they once had at the beginning of the project is now restored, and no one has abandoned his or her station. The builders are once again devoted to the task and to the sacrifices that it requires. They are in this together. This allows us to look ahead to the completion of the project. In chapter 6, it tells us that the wall was complete on the 25th of the month of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. Only with God's help are the people able to achieve this remarkable accomplishment in so little time. As the psalm tells us, unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord guards the city, the guards keep watch in vain. And it required the people to stand firm and persevere together in the face of opposition and threats. In Ephesians chapter 6, in that famous passage about the armor of God that I was alluding to earlier, Paul writes to the Christians in Ephesus, in much the same way that Nehemiah addressed the merchants and officials and villagers who were stationed along the wall. He says, finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. And after you have done everything, to stand. Like a general motivating his troops before battle, Paul calls on us to stand firm and persevere and stand our ground in the great battle that we find ourselves in. This, Paul says, is a spiritual battle against the rulers and authorities, against the powers of this dark world and the spiritual forces of evil. It's important to be clear about naming who the enemy is. Our struggle isn't against flesh and blood. It's not people who are our enemy. Paul is not calling for a crusade against the ungodly or the unbelievers, or those who think or act or behave differently than you or me. But he wants us to recognize that there are spiritual realities, forces of evil, who do not want to see Christians remain faithful and united, who do not want to see the church restored and the body of Christ built up. Like the builders of the wall in Nehemiah's day, we face a formidable enemy. Threats both from within and without. What is required of us is to stand firm. Four times Paul repeats this word, stand against the devil's schemes, to stand firm, stand your ground. And after you have done everything, to stand. This posture, as is the case with the armor and the weapons that Paul goes on to name, is a primarily defensive posture. Eugene Peterson explains, Paul saying, brace yourselves, keep your footing, neither in panic before the enemy nor in crusade against it, but stand firm in the face of ridicule and discouragement and attack. Stand firm against the devil's schemes of bitterness and anger, jealousy and discord. Stand firm against resentment and unforgiveness, against blame and burnout. Stand firm against the roadblocks and trials and the circumstances that are beyond your control that we face every day. Stand firm against the voices of intimidation and discouragement and fear. Our chief weapon in this struggle, for Paul as it was for Nehemiah, is prayer. Six times in the three verses at the end of this passage in Ephesians, Paul calls on us to pray. Verses 18 through 20, he writes, pray in the Spirit, on all occasions, with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert, and always keep on praying for all the Lord's people. Pray also for me, that whenever I speak, words may be given me so that I will fearlessly make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains. Pray that I may declare it fearlessly as I should. Practically speaking, to put on the armor of God is to pray faithfully, habitually, consistently. So pray for our church. Pray for our pastors and our leaders. Prayerfully stand guard over those who work hard among us. Pray for our denomination and for the church throughout our county and our surrounding area, for a spirit of unity and cooperation among the churches. Pray for one another and encourage and support each other. Pray for those who are discouraged and are burned out and who have fallen away. Pray for those who've been hurt and for those you've been hurt by. Pray for those bearing heavy burdens. We may not bear those burdens alone. And in this way, taking up the armor of prayer, may we stand firm and accomplish the work to which God has called us. I'm going to leave you with a few questions as we transition to a time of response. Who will you pray for? Who will you encourage this week? How will you stand firm before the challenges that you face? I'm going to give you a moment to spend with those questions before we sing our next hymn.